Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And from Angie's List, with reviews on local contractors and doctors in 500 categories, with ratings based only on member feedback, angieslist.com. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Paul Thomas Anderson talks about writing and directing his new film, The Master, starring Philip Seymour Hoffman as the leader of a cult group in 1950, and Joaquin Phoenix as a troubled World War II vet who makes his way into the group. Anderson also directed Boogie Nights and There Will Be Blood. Join us.
This is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Allison Stewart.
This broadcast is sponsored in part by Ron's Apothecary at the Mendenhall Mall. Seasonal changes may cause muscle strains and sprains. Ron's Apothecary carries a selection of resources for recovery. First aid kits, healing ointments, braces, and more. Ron's Apothecary at the Mendenhall Mall.
At the next Evening at Egan, Boston-based photographer Skip Scheel gives a multimedia presentation, Israel, the Occupied Territories and Nonviolent Resistance. Scheel's photographs document the reality of the occupation and highlight Palestinian and Israeli nonviolent responses. Friday, September 28th, 7 p.m. at the University of Alaska Southeast Egan Lecture Hall. More information about Skip Scheel and the Evening at Egan series can be found at uas.alaska.edu.
Good afternoon and welcome to a Juno Afternoon. This is Katie Bosler. It's 3 o'clock and you are listening to KTOO 104.3 FM in Juneau, Alaska. Looks like we have mostly cloudy skies. It looks like sun out there to me with more sun tomorrow, or partly cloudy with the lows to 37 degrees and the highs, around 50. So pretty nice fall weather in here in the capital city. Coming up in the next hour, we're going to hear from Cheryl Walsh about National Disability Employment Awareness Month, about First Friday with the Artist Open Studio, Canvas Happenings, and First Friday at the Jack. So lots happening in the capital city, and on a Juno afternoon, it's always full this time of year, the fall time of year. And also want to let you know that that UAS announcement you heard was from last week. This Friday, Evening at Egan is a talk about arts in the capital city with a really powerful trio. And now, National Native News.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Mercury levels in walleye in northern Wisconsin are increasing in some lakes and decreasing in others. Mike Simonson reports the new study by the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission isn't completely consistent with other studies.
Blithwick is in its second year of a three-year grant from the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, a federal program dedicated to cleaning up and restoring habitat. Environmental biologist Sarah Moses says for the first time in 6 years, they've been able to put together a new map which gives individual fish consumption advisories by color-coding more than 300 inland lakes.
We had 10 that now have slightly stricter consumption, meaning that we're finding that the mercury levels are a little higher than when we tested before, but at the same time, there's 11 that are slightly less strict, so it's really 50-50.
Moses says Glyphwick has been sampling fish for mercury for nearly a quarter of a century. They're also comparing their findings with Michigan, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and the EPA. Some of those studies show mercury is on the increase.
It's good that they haven't been going up steeply, but even at the lower levels that we see now compared to, say, in the 70s or the 80s when they were really at their peak, they're still high enough to trigger consumption advisories in just about every state in the nation. So we really hope to someday get to the level where there's unrestricted fish consumption.
Moses believes stricter emission controls are decreasing the amount of mercury coming into the Great Lakes from the air, but she says researchers are not finding a similar decline in mercury in the fish. For National Native News, I'm Mike Simonson.
Drought conditions continue to plague the middle of the U.S. Some tribal land in South Dakota is looking for any kind of relief. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports.
The weekly drought monitor puts the northern part of South Dakota in a moderate drought. That's worse than the abnormally dry category in the north the last few weeks. Southeast South Dakota is still in exceptional drought, including Yankton Sioux tribal land. A small part of the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation is in the most severe category as well. Mike Gillespie with the National Weather Service in Sioux Falls says not much rain is in the forecast for the next several days.
And then as we go longer range into the 30 and 90 day outlooks, it does look like we're probably still going to see for October and November, possibly even into December as well, normal to above normal temperatures continuing. But there is a chance, at least for much of the state, looks like we could get back to more of a normal type precipitation pattern. So that won't necessarily help things out, but it'll keep things from getting any worse.
The drought monitor map shows at least three quarters of Nebraska and a good part of Oklahoma in exceptional drought. Conditions are worsening in Minnesota and parts of North Dakota as well. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellen Bolt.
Washington educators want schools in the state to get rid of their Native American mascots. According to the Associated Press, the State Board of Education passed a resolution last week urging districts to stop using Indian mascots. But the board doesn't have authority to mandate changes. The resolution is similar to one passed in the 90s, inspired by research by the American Psychological Association, which showed Indian mascots may have adverse effects on students. About 10 schools in the last 10 years have retired their Indian mascots. There are more than four dozen schools, including tribal schools, with names like Warrior, Braves, and Redskins. The U.S. Justice Department awards more than $100 million to tribes. More than 200 grants will go to more than 100 tribes across the country. The funds will help enhance law enforcement practices and sustain crime prevention and intervention efforts in areas like elder abuse, violence against women, and juvenile justice. The department announced the grants last week. During this week in 2011, the first woman chief of the Mississippi Band of Choctaw Indians was sworn into office. Phyllis Anderson took the oath of office during a ceremony on the tribe's reservation in Mississippi. Anderson is fluent in the Choctaw language and has more than two decades of experience with tribal government, including serving on the tribal council and as secretary treasurer. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kowanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
On KTOO FM in Juneau, this is Katie Bosler, your Monday host for a Juneau Afternoon. And with me in the studio is Cheryl Walsh. She's the director of the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation for the State of Alaska, based here in the capital city. Welcome, Cheryl.
Thank you, Katie. Thank you for having me.
Good to have you here. So tell me about your job. What does it encompass? I'm sure a lot.
Well, the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation has several different programs that we administer. Most people are most familiar with our employment program, where most people refer to us as DVR. That's the common mm-hmm. term that people know us by. But we also administer the Social Security Disability Program. When people apply, we determine whether or not they meet the medical requirements to establish disability. And we administer the grants for independent living programs and for assistive technology in addition to our employment program.
And it's October 1st, and it is also National Disability Employment Awareness Month, and that's what you're here to talk about.
Yes, yeah? That's correct. since the early 40s, we've had disability employment awareness. It started out as a week, and now it currently consists of a month, the month of October. And the purpose is to bring awareness to the fact of the disproportionate rate of people with disabilities who are unemployed and the large numbers of people in society who have disabilities who would like to be employed. We figure that in the state of Alaska alone, there are probably 70,000 people with disabilities, and about 34% of people with disabilities are employed compared to almost 70% that without disabilities who are employed. So it's a huge disparity of the number of people who are able to work.
So you help disabled people to get training for jobs or get placed in jobs? How does it work?
It's highly individual. A person can acquire disability in a variety of ways. Some people are born with a medical condition. Some might acquire one through, let's say, a four-wheeler accident or automobile accident. Sometimes a person will have a heart attack and end up with some limitations. Sometimes they even get a disability based on a medical treatment that they received. Sometimes if you're going through chemotherapy, you might have long-term memory loss. So the people with disabilities are as varied as they come. So our services are tailored to meet what their particular employment barriers are and help them to overcome them.
So can you give me an example, maybe someone that you or one of your employees has worked with lately? I mean, don't just give any names, but just kind of what you would do for this person?
Well, as a director, I'm not doing direct services to people,
right.
But in general, you say you had someone who had a spinal cord injury. And that often happens to young people who have lots of hopes and dreams, and many of them believe that their life is going to be altered in such a way that they won't have any more enjoyment in their life. And so what the most important work that the counselors do is they help a person to understand what all their choices are. We call that informed choice. And it helps them to understand that they can still go to school or they could, you know, they can work. You can show them the new technology that's available that can enable a person to access computers through their voice alone. So I think what we do is oftentimes help a person to adjust to their new situation that they aren't familiar with.
Mm. And how about job placement? How does that work?
The way the process works is first we have to determine eligibility for the program, and that's based on medical evidence that the counselor and the person often provides that information. And then we look at it and we determine, well, what in that condition is creating the barriers to employment? And then we develop a plan with them. And it's a plan of services, and we determine, well, if you need to have training, there's a gap in your skills, and you need, let's say, a vocational school program, then we help to determine what they wanted to be, let's say, an auto mechanic. And so what are they going to need to do that? And then we map out all the way until they would go to work what they might need. Oftentimes that might include tools. It could include some of the assistive technology, the training. And when they get toward the end of their schooling or their training program, then we would work with them to develop their resumes, do the job-seeking skills, to find employers. Many times a person, based on what they've received through the counselor, can go and find their own job. They just needed a leg up. They needed kind of the playing field to be leveled for them.
Now, you're also connected with the job center.
That's correct. Our Juneau office is located in the job center out on the Glacier Highway.
Yeah, on the way to DMV.
Correct.
I guess just past the turnoff.
Just past
Don
Abel.
Yeah.
Up in the third floor.
Okay, so if somebody is disabled and wanted some of the services that your agency offers through the job center, do they need to make an appointment, or how do they go about getting things started?
The first thing they might want to do is to go to our website. And on our website, we actually have an orientation video, so they can preview that and get an idea of whether or not they might be interested in the program. And it also has, we try to be pretty transparent, so we have all of our policies and procedures on the website. We have some of our successes, some of our stats, if somebody's interested in looking at that. So the whole process is on the website. So they can look at that video, and then they can make a call out to the office. It's best to make an appointment because our counselors are working with people all day, and you might drop in and they might be meeting with someone. So it's best to make an appointment. And we also offer an in-person orientation so they can come out and speak directly with the counselor to decide whether or not they want to apply.
Okay. And then how about, I mean, you did mention a little bit ago that often people just need a leg up through this program and then can apply for their own job. But does the does your agency or its affiliate through the job center also help place people in jobs?
Yes, we can if someone requires that. We work through, we call them community rehab providers, community rehabilitation providers, and we can contract with someone to provide that individualized services and actually spend more time than we might have available. And they can, if they need to, knock on doors and do the job placement. Also, we work really closely with the staff at the job center themselves, and they have a lot of good contacts there as well.
So about how many clients do you have?
Last year we served 4,100 people, and actually we worked with 420 different employers to help, you know, that's who hired the people that we are working with. As a result of our work, 637 people went to work.
And what are some examples of some of the fields that people work in?
I have worked, when I was a counselor, I assisted a gentleman who was a college professor that was riding his bicycle and had a head and a neck, a spinal cord injury. We have architects, we have office assistants. It's as wide a range as the general population.
And so you do help to train and sometimes place people in new positions or new fields. But what about people who already have been employed long-term? You mentioned that the college professor. Is that very common?
Yes. Oftentimes a person, and we're finding it more and more with the baby boomers as well, because people, as they age, there's some medical conditions that are related to age, and some of those oftentimes are visual impairments. And employers have made a significant investment in their employees, and oftentimes they would like to hang on to those employees rather than start over with rehiring, with the hiring process. Recruiting a new employee and training them is very expensive. So we will often get a call from them, and they'll say, can you assist this individual? We really want to keep them on our payroll. So we'll often suggest to them that they talk to the individual about applying for services, because the person themselves have to want to come and receive services from us. So we help a great number of people just to keep what they have going. It's very disruptive to start a new job.
All right. I'm talking to Cheryl Walsh, who is the Director of Division of Vocational Rehabilitation for the state, about National Disability Employment Awareness Month. Cheryl, is there anything you want to add?
I guess I'd just like to add one thing is that the governor has also put out a proclamation for National Disability Employment Awareness Month. And one thing that I was really pleased that the governor included in this proclamation is recognizing that the state should be a model employee for people with disabilities and has really made a commitment to that. And as part of that, has a task force that's been established to make sure that people who work in state government can have the accommodations that they need to be successful on the job, and that there is a strategies that will be developed to make sure that we recruit really qualified candidates that just also happen to have a disability. So I would encourage people to go to his website and take a look at that proclamation, or you may see it in the job centers. I think that this is really a big year for us to make a good push for people with disabilities. The National Governors Association also has a year-long strategy, and the governor from Delaware has named the initiative A Better Bottom Line, Employing People with Disabilities, because if we allow our country to have people sit on the sidelines and not participate, we will not have a good economic recovery.
Okay, go ahead.
there's just so many people that have disabilities, and if they're not participating in the workforce or in participating in their communities, I think we all lose from that. The diversity is gone, and if you choose to support people rather than encourage them to support themselves or take their family members out of the job market in order to help them, I think we're really doing a disservice to America.
And if people want to learn how to contact your agency or the job center to get more information about these services, is there a website or phone number that we can give?
Yes, our website is www.labor.state.ak.us/DVR.
Okay, or they could just, I guess, Google Dave Alaska.
Department of Labor.
Okay, great.
And you'll find us listed on there as well. And or you can call our Juneau branch office at 465-8943 for more information.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming in, Cheryl Walsh, the Director of the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation. And here we go with Walking on My Wheels from Nobody Else Like Me.
The Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 1st of October, 2012. It's the anniversary of the first computed tomography scan, the CT scan, sometimes called a CAT scan for computed axial tomography. It was done on a patient on this date in 1971 at Atkinson Morley's Hospital in London. A woman who was suspected of having a tumor in her frontal lobe. The CT scan produces images of cross-sections or slices of the human body and enables doctors to examine soft tissues. Partial credit for the development of the CT scanner was due to the Beatles because their record label, EMI, earned so much money off the Beatles they had plenty of money to invest in the research of the CT's inventor, Sir Godfrey Hounsfield. It's the anniversary of the first ever World Series game, 1903, on this date, the Pittsburgh Pirates versus the Boston Americans. Pittsburgh won the first game 7-3, but in the end, Boston won four games in a row to take the series 5-3. It's the birthday of the social historian Daniel Borstein, born in Atlanta, not a historian by training, studied law, and he didn't write about battles and political events so much as social and intellectual history and the daily experiences of ordinary people. His great hero was Edward Gibbon, author of The History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. Daniel Borstein later became Librarian of Congress, and one of his first acts was to demand that the library's big bronze doors be left standing wide open. People said it would create a draft, and Mr. Borstein said, "Great, that's just what we need." And it's the birthday of the novelist Tim O'Brien, born in Austin, Minnesota, 1946. He was drafted to fight in the war in Vietnam. The same summer he graduated from college, served for 4 years, got out of the service, got a job at the Washington Post, and wrote a memoir, came out in 1973, "If I Die in a Combat Zone, Box Me Up and Ship Me Home." His most famous book came out in 1990, "The Things They Carried," a collection of short stories about the war. Tim O'Brien said, "A true war story is never moral. It does not instruct nor encourage virtue nor suggest models of proper human behavior. If a story seems moral, do not believe it. If at the end of a war story you feel uplifted, you have been made the victim of a very old and terrible lie. There is no rectitude, there is no virtue. As a first rule of thumb, therefore, you can tell a true war story by its absolute and uncompromising allegiance to obscenity and evil." Here's a poem for today by Ursula K. Le Guin entitled "Science." "What little we have ever understood is like an offering we make beside the sea. It is pure worship when pursued as its own end to find out. Mystery, the undiminishable silent flood, stretches on out from where we pray around the clear altar flame. The God accepts the sacrifice and turns away." Science, a poem by Ursula K. Le Guin from her collection Finding My Elegy, New and Selected Poems, 1960 to 2010, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by Reputation.com, helping businesses leverage a powerful form of advertising, online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com. And by Goddard College, offering low residency bachelor's and master's of fine arts degrees in creative writing. More at Goddard.edu. Written by Holly Vanderhaar, produced by Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
And you're in touch right here on K2, Juno Afternoon. This is your Monday host, Katie Bosler. And with me in the studio now is Christine Crooks, an artist and representing the Artists Open Studio, and here to tell us about a very exciting effort on their behalf. Welcome, Christine.
Oh, thanks, Katie. Hi.
Good to have you here.
Yeah, yes. It's great to be here.
So, gosh, lots happening here. Well, first, I guess, tell us about the Artists Open Studios. This is something new.
Yes, it's new for Juneau. This is going to be the second time that we've had this opportunity. It actually has been happening around the country, especially on the West Coast, over maybe 10, 20 years. And it's an opportunity for artists to very generously open the doors of their studios, invite people in who might be interested in seeing the process of creating art, and see some of the artists' work. We've invited artists to exhibit one piece of their work at the Franklin Street Gallery opening this first Friday. And then during the month, there's a schedule that you can pick up there or find online when the different artists have chosen a day or a couple of days in some cases where they invite the public just to come and visit their studio. So it's for people who've really been interested in how an artist gets ideas and, you know, the finished work you see in a frame up on a wall is beautiful, but, you know, there's many, many hours and thought processes that go into creating that piece of work.
Yeah, what, and that whole process.
Yeah.
Which I find personally fascinating.
Well, you know, a lot of us who are going to be exhibiting are also outdoor painters, plein air painters. We call ourselves Plein Rain. And but there are a lot of artists who actually work primarily in their studios. We have 15 different artists this year are going to be exhibiting and inviting people in. And we know it's hard sometimes to get the word out. Not everybody has internet connections or actually has made connections with this group. And so we put a website up, and we're hoping that next year we'll be able to even expand it more so that people can apply right online. It really is just an opportunity for the public, and the artists then can sell their work. People could buy work at the studios if they want or at the gallery. But it's really more about the process of art and learn about art and the artists in town.
Okay, so folks, if you do just want to go online and it's very easy, Google Juneau Open Studios, you'll get the information about the First Friday event, which happens at the Baranoff Hotel Franklin Street Gallery. That's this Friday from 4:30 to 6:30. But then if you click on the schedule of October studio openings, which I'll do right now. Now, do people need to make an appointment or they just come by?
There will be scheduled times, and there will also be little cards there, and a lot of the artists are open to people calling them and making a different appointment time.
Okay.
We just ask that each artist select at least 4 hours when they would be available. So there's a nice window of opportunity for people to go.
And from what I see here, Christine, it looks like your studio open house, if you will, is coming right up.
It is this Saturday. Better start cleaning.
I know that feeling. So you're a neighbor. If I wanted to, you know, just come down to your studio and say hello, how would I go about that?
Yeah, just from I'm going to be open from 12 to 4 and just invite people to come on down. My studio is actually a beautiful little spot on the beach. And so you just come on down some covered stairs, and I'll be in there painting in case nobody comes, doing some work, and, you know, can show what I've been working on and talk about art. And maybe people who've ever wanted to be an artist would get inspired.
That sounds wonderful. And yeah, you're very specific. We want to go 85 steps down to the beach, noon to 4. And then, folks, this is really exciting. Then, for example, the following Saturday, you have Nancy Russell Brown, who is on 11th Street downtown. Specific instructions to her studio as well, 10 to 2. This is really great. This is an artist's collective that organized this?
Well, the Franklin Street Gallery is there in the Baranoff Hotel, and there's 5 of us who co-manage it. And Pulama'unu last year had gotten this brainstorm that we really should be doing something like this in Juneau. As I said, it's a very common thing in other art communities around the country. And Juneau certainly has a wealth of wonderful artists. And it's really generosity on the part of these artists to open their studios and just invite people in. So we're looking for people who love art to come and visit.
And this is throughout the month of October.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Oh. And online, I'll race home and make sure everybody's schedule is up to date there. And so we do have 15 artists. Should I read their names?
Certainly.
Yes, we have Dan Fruits, M.K. McNaughton, Michelle Morell, David Woody, Christine Crooks, Jerry Smetzer, Pua Ma'unu, T. Timmy Johnson, Sharon Lobaugh, Rob Royce, David Riccio, Barbara Craver, Mustafa Bea, Jane Stokes, and Nancy Roselle Brown.
That's quite a list.
Yeah, and probably names people recognize.
Oh yes, wonderful artists.
Yeah,
local artists. The talent and the vibrancy of our local arts community never ceases to amaze me.
And this is a really nice diverse group of artists. Everything from watercolors to full huge scale oil paintings.
And so there'll be an example from each of these artists at the First Friday event this Friday.
Right. And throughout the gallery, the whole month at the gallery, those paintings will be displayed. And then one other thing, the Plain Rain Painters annually make a little art calendar. So this is the first shout out to all those people who say, I never heard that you were selling them again. and we are going to also be displaying at the Franklin Street Gallery for a month the paintings that went into the calendar. So these are the original paintings that then were reproduced in the calendar. And the calendar will be for sale just First Friday and then at some of the Plain Rain Painters open studios. We'll also have them. And then usually towards Christmas time, the Jack will sell them also.
Okay, so both the Juno Open Studios examples and the Plain Rain paintings from the calendar will be at the First Friday.
Correct.
Oh, my gosh, so much happening.
Yeah, it'll be a great First Friday.
Yes, Christine Crooks, is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for coming in and sharing this with us. I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, thanks.
That was New York Polyphony. They will be giving a performance at Thunder Mountain High School on October 9th at 7 o'clock. For more information about that, I'm sure you can go to the Juno Arts and Humanities Council website. I was in a church in Europe or something. This is Katie Bosler, your Monday host for a Juno Afternoon, and with me in the studio now is Chris Taylor from the Canvas. He is the artistic coordinator, and I think October is Art Month in the capital city, and he's here to tell us what's happening on the Canvas end.
We have a lot going on down at the Canvas in October. We'll be participating in the First Friday Gallery Walk, as usual, and we'll have Arnie Weimer. We'll be presenting a whole bunch of new work.
Arnie Weimer. Oh, my gosh. What an artist.
Yeah, he's great. I know he's a big Juno favorite.
Yeah.
Anytime I tell people, they get pretty excited about seeing his stuff.
Yes.
And he'll be doing a variety of watercolor kind of landscape or cityscape scenes, and then also some, from what he's explained, some abstract, more free and fun stuff. So looking forward to seeing the work. We'll be hanging it Wednesday, and I'll be doing the opening on First Friday.
Okay.
Yep. And then we also have a bunch of classes coming up, and we're trying to kind of set up a new scheduling out at the Canvas, trying to create kind of a building block program, some classes that kind of start at the foundation and then kind of link into the next class that take it a little bit farther up to advanced classes. So a lot of the classes I'm going to mention now have follow-up courses that take things a little bit farther with the same instructor, so it's kind of a good opportunity for people to get in and build their skill starting at the beginning or brush up on old skills. And so starting off, we'll be having still life watercolor class with instructor Ava Valise. She's a very skilled watercolor painter. That's going to be on Saturdays. It's a four-week class from 2 to 4, starting October 6th. Then we'll have David Woody, who's also a fantastic Juno painter, and he'll be doing a still life oil painting class. That's going to be on Wednesday evenings from 6:30 to 9, starting October 10th. And both of those classes, like I said, will lead into a little more advanced classes in November and December, such as landscape painting and some figure painting in both oil and watercolor. We also have Sherry McDonald, who's going to be doing papermaking classes, and basically the focus is just going to be making a whole wide variety of different types of papers. And the idea behind that is there will be future classes where you'll be taking those papers and making collage pieces in her style, which I think is fantastic. It's going to be a fun class. And then we also have a new instructor, Angie Lawler. She's going to be teaching a kind of a beginning jewelry class. It's going to be focused on cold connections, so no soldering, just kind of learning the basics of etching and riveting, and you'll be building jewelry in that manner, and that's going to start October 8th. It'll be Monday evenings. It's a three-hour class, and that'll be a four-week class. And then we have Joel Abbott, who will be starting an intermediate stained glass class October 25th. That'll be Thursday evenings, and that's going to be a seven-week class, a little bit longer. So give some of the skilled stained glass artists extra time to make a great piece. And that one, like I said, starting October 25th. And then we will also be having Joel doing a stained glass workshop October 20th. And that's going to be a five-hour class, and that's just an opportunity for anyone to finish up projects they might have started and didn't get a chance to finish, or bring in some personal work if they want some feedback, or if they're stuck and they don't know where to go. That would be a fun workshop to do for those kind of people. And we have one of our longtime favorite artists, Luis Kunstada, teaching a Halloween pottery scareware class. That's going to be...
Scareware.
Scareware, yeah. So jack-o'-lanterns, haunted houses, and things like that. And it's a great class for parents and kids to do together, or just kids to do. She's really great with
wonderful.
Children and great
yeah.
with parents, great potter, very talented. So that one's going to start October 20th and October 27th are the two class dates from 10 to 1. And... that's kind of it for classes. We do have a couple more on our website if you want to check that out. But I also wanted to just take a chance to talk a little bit about our annual Halloween party that we have coming up.
Okay. What is the website if people want to find out more about these classes?
www.canvasarts.org.
Okay, so that's easy.
Mm-hmm.
www.canvasartsalloneword.org.
Yep, with an S, yeah.
Okay. Well, gosh, so many opportunities for artists and aspiring artists.
Yeah, definitely. And it's a great place to go.
Yeah. All right. And now, tell us about your Halloween event.
All right. So it's an annual Halloween party, and mm-hmm. they've had it for as long as I've been here, which isn't very long, but I think they did it pretty much from the beginning. A lot of the reach artists that we have love Halloween, so they've been working on decorations for the place for pretty much the last month, and we'll continue all the way up to the 26th, which is the party date. We'll start off from 2 to 6 doing a Halloween carnival for all ages. It's going to have a lot of fun events and games and prizes and face painting stations and things like that, so it should be a fun event. And then we have a from 6 to 7, we will have a scary campfire story. So we'll have a makeshift campfire and sit around and hear scary
A real campfire?
Yeah, lights underneath, no fire, no
flame.
No
open because it'll be indoors,
right? We're going to set the mood nice. So,
okay.
And we'll have Tom Manning's one of the storytellers. He's going to tell his rendition of When the Log Rolls Over.
Oh, boy.
Which is a nice, scary story for kids. And then we'll have an hour break, and then from 8 to 10 we'll be showing Beetlejuice in the gallery, turned it into a little movie theater. And that one, you know, we're saying 13 and up, unless accompanied by a parent. That should be fun. We'll have popcorn and people dressed up in scary outfits, and it should be a good time.
All right. Well, Chris Taylor, thank you so much for coming in. Anything you want to add?
No, we just hope to see everyone out on First Friday and stop in the canvas and say hi.
Okay, well, again, Arnie Weimer has the exhibit this first Friday, and that is a 4:30 to 7. Okay, and any more information about what's happening at the Canvas this month and the Halloween party, you just go to canvasarts.org.
Yep.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Katie.
At the next Evening at Egan, the directors of the Juno Symphony, Perseverance Theater, and Juno Jazz and Classics discuss the audacity of making large-scale productions in a small town. Art Roach, Kyle Pickett, and Linda Rosenthal on the state of the arts in today's economic and cultural climate with questions from the audience. Big Arts in a Small Town, Friday, October 5th, 7 p.m. in the Egan Lecture Hall at the University of Alaska Southeast.
This is Bird Note. Just a couple of dozen miles off the Pacific coast, immense dark birds with long saber-shaped wings glide without effort above the wave tops. These graceful giants are black-footed albatrosses, flying by the thousands near the edge of the continental shelf. Albatrosses arc and coast over the ocean for hours, with hardly a flap of their wings, making the most of wind currents and shifts in air pressure. These wondrous seabirds seem to levitate over the water. Black-footed albatross numbers peak off the coast in summer. Many adults return to the Hawaiian Islands during our winter and spring to court and nest on sandy islands. In Hawaiian waters, the black-footed albatross collects squid and masses of flying fish eggs with its long, hook-tipped bill. Adult birds may fly hundreds of miles at sea to provide food for the single Goliath nestling, which looks more than a little like a portly, gray, recumbent version of Big Bird. The writers of Bird Note include Bob Sundstrom, Ellen Blackstone, Todd Peterson, Dennis Paulson, and Francis Wood. You can come to our website, birdnote.org, and read their scripts anytime. I'm Michael Stein.
Help SAIL celebrate 20 years of inspiring personal independence by joining us for our annual dinner and auction on October 12th from 6 to 9 p.m. at Centennial Hall. Special guest speaker First Lady Sandy Parnell and others will help us look back at all we've done and look forward to what's to come. A seasonal dinner catered by Abby's Kitchen, fantastic auction items, and live music are sure to make it a special evening. Tickets available at saleinc.org or call 586-4920.
This is Katie Bosler back at you on a Juno afternoon, and with me now in the studio is Khaki Shields. She's a photographer, and she is one of two artists who will be displaying their work and on hand at a First Friday at the Juno Arts and Culture Center this Friday, the 5th of October. Welcome, Khaki.
Thanks.
Good to have you here. So, gosh, fascinating exhibit you have here, snapshots and postcards about Juno as a border town where the wild meets the city, the tourist meets both. Tell us, what do you have going here?
Well, both Annie and I submitted ideas to the JAC, and they put us together. We actually didn't know each other.
Okay,
at the time. So we're one of those pairings they've done, and it's turned out to be a really good pairing because
we are both
new to town. I've been here 5 years. She just got here last year. And when I say I've been here 5 years, that means I came and I left and I came and I left, and then I came back and pretty much stayed. So we both have this sort of vision of both Alaska and Juneau in particular. Mm. And we've done a lot of talking about what that means, and that's what we've both done pictures about.
What a partnership, but an arranged partnership.
An arranged, yes. You could,
but it's worked out.
Absolutely, but it's worked out really well.
Okay,
yes.
So Annie Wedler, for those of you who don't know, is a faculty in art at the University of Alaska Southeast and one of my colleagues, though I'm not a professor, of course. I'm a PR person, but very interesting woman. And so tell us about your half here, your photographs.
Well, I didn't call it photography. I call it snapshots and postcards because that's really how I see these. A lot of them are, a lot of them aren't very serious, thank goodness. they group kind of. There's the way the city of Juneau slams up against the mountains and those 50s buildings look against those wonderful mountains, how good and bad that can be. The way that you
the
have
juxtaposition.
The noble eagle, the noble bear, and the noble raven, but how they hang out downtown, like the bear that kept appearing on roofs last week.
By a dumpster?
Yeah, exactly. Totally. I've got lots of those kinds of pictures. The tourists, and of course how the tourists are, how we cameras glued to their faces most of the time. I did a lot of shooting out at Mendenhall.
That is kind of surreal, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
But here,
fascinating.
I mean, not that I don't do the same thing
right.
when I'm, you know, in Italy, for example.
Right.
But that you think, are you really
here?
It's almost like it's almost a once removed experience thing.
Yes, I think that really happens. And then the other thing, of course, is coming here. And my first summer, I basically worked at Tony Ting's. I, you know, ran the ice cream parlor like 50% of the people who live here in Juneau have done. And I was just struck, of course, by the fact that you got on the wharf and these huge ships were twice as tall as any of the buildings downtown. So I've done some forced sort of perspectives where those smack together, too. Anyway, that's just the kind of thing I...
So it's kind of,
part of what I like
kind
to
of that
at.
Artist's eye, if you will, or sensibility about what is this about?
Right. And then there's the myth that we all tell ourselves, right?
Which is?
What is it? I mean, here I am in Alaska. I'm pretty old to have come to Alaska for the first time, really, you know. But it definitely, it's the American myth still, right? It's the great land. Look at my T-shirt.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Folks, I wish that this was on video because Khaki has outfitted herself in I call it wearable art. Tell us about what you've created to wear to your opening on Friday.
Well, I realized I had to have something special. And, of course, it's end of season, so I went around to the T-shirt shops that are all closing down. Probably I could have bought some diamonds, too, but I didn't get there. And I found a bunch of T-shirts and sweatshirts, and I've assembled what I think is actually quite an attractive skirt, rather Japanese in design, that features a lot of logos about both Juneau and
Alaska.
Okay,
so you've pieced together.
I pieced it together with a little help
T-shirt.
From Bridget, you know, at...
Oh, you knew where you knew who to go to.
I knew who to go to, for sure. But then the masterpiece is the one I am wearing, which has this shirt has rhinestones. I didn't do a thing to it. It's
oh my God, that is fabulous!
It's rhinestones. It is a photo copy of some amazing combination of eagles and roses. If you can come Friday, you can see it.
It's black and beige.
Yes, it's gorgeous.
The Alaskan experience. Wow,
rhinestones too.
Now, and now that the shops are all shut down, aren't they? So
this is special.
You got the last one.
I believe so, until next summer. So I just think it says a lot, maybe, about this show, at least from my perspective. That, Annie wouldn't necessarily agree with
folks,
me about
this shirt is something else, really. It's both sort of Renaissance and Renaissance means Real Housewives of Orange County.
I am thinking about putting for sale tags on all the clothing I'll be wearing on Friday too. That's sort of something about new to town as well, right?
I am getting so excited about this First Friday. There's so much going on. We've learned a lot about this Juno afternoon. And Khaki Shields, it's a pleasure to meet you and hear about your work. Is there anything you want to add about your opening this Friday at the Juno Arts and Culture Center, the Jack, with Annie Wedler?
Let me think. No, just that we're hoping the zombies are going to show up, and we don't. There's a
couple other
things happening, so it should be a lot of fun.
Well, thank you so much for coming in, and all the best to you this Friday.
Thank you.
Programming on this station is provided by Lauren Jones, candidate for the City and Borough Assembly. Paid for by Jones for Assembly, Box 240703, Douglas.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon on KTOO FM 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. This is the Melody of Rhythm, a triple concerto for music trio with Bela Fleck, Zakir Hussain, and Edgar Meyer, and the Detroit Symphony Orchestra. Leonard Slatkin, the music director. It's just about 4 o'clock here on K2, and we'll be getting to All Things Considered momentarily, but I want to let you know that we also broadcast in the Valley and Ock Bay area on 103.1 or K276 AF. That's a translator. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, the translator is K269 AO 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear K2 on K210 AS 89.9. And in Juneau, you can also hear us on GCI Cable at channel 871, KRNN 872, KXLL at 873. You can always visit us online, the K3 stations, starting with KTOO.org. And folks, I want to let you know that in about an hour, I will be on our sister station, KRNN, at 102.7, and Dean Frank and a djembe player will be my special guest playing live music. I'll also probably have a special birthday set for my son, Kanan, who turns 24 today. I will see you on the radio next week here on a Juno Afternoon on Monday.
He's a little more formal than some of the folks that I've worked with and less aggressive, but I think that style seems to suit him pretty well.